everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of one reality that we see below the surface.
Yeah, that's right. And this is episode number 45.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about The Sixth Sense by M. Night Shyamalan. Directed
perfect.
And written and produced, I think.
Yes.
One of everything. Yes, yes. Now, yeah, he did this movie when he was not very well known, right? This was the one that launched him into everybody's sight.
Yeah, and I think he had just a couple, maybe little indie movies before that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how he was put in the spot of making this great big movie with these stars.
Yeah. Well, Bruce Willis was a big star, right? And I don't know that people knew who Haley Joel Osment was, but they sure did after this movie.
Yeah, that's true. I guess Bruce Willis is the only true star that's in it. You and I know Toni Collette, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was in About a Boy, which was another episode we did.
Yep. And she was Mary's adult voice in Mary and Max.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Episode. That's right. So this is, I forgot about that one. So this is our third Toni Collette cast.
I know. So Joss Whedon or Toni Collette, we'll go either way.
Both excellent. Both excellent. Well, I feel like before we begin, we should just say a quick spoiler statement, because more than probably any other movie I can think of.
Yeah.
This movie ought to be watched without any knowledge at all about what you're going to see. So that's pretty much our only warning or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt compelled that we ought to say that here. Because if you haven't heard about this movie and you have not seen it, please turn this off and go see it before we take this joy away from you.
Yes. Well, and I would say that I remembered from my first time of seeing it that it was scarier than, I mean, that there were a lot more gruesome things than there actually were.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of jump scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's not like a slasher or anything like that. I mean, it's really a good classic old style suspense movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. I'm trying to think of the directors that remind me of Shyamalan or who Shyamalan seems to be emulating. One of them is Hitchcock.
Because, that's who I thought of.
Because it's the same type of movie. It's the same type of suspense. Mm-hmm. But Shyamalan has this added spiritual dimension that he adds in most of the movies I've seen that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Which make them extremely interesting to me. I love his movies. I really respect the guy, and I always try to catch them when they come out. I still have not seen two of his movies. One of them is The Last Airbender. I never did see that. And the other one is called Devil, which has something to do with some people on an elevator.
But I think he produced it.
Right. I was going to say he did not direct that one. I don't know if he wrote it. He had something to do with that movie. So one of these days I'll catch it. I was going to try to catch it before this podcast, but I didn't. One movie that I hadn't seen up till now that I did catch before this podcast was The Happening.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. So I did get that watched. And Rose, your daughter Rose, made a really excellent statement last time we talked to her. She said that, the Happening was a movie that was not very well received. And she said that a couple of people that she respects really enjoyed it because they saw it as a throwback. And you used the word throwback on The Sixth Sense, too. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But it was a throwback to old science fiction monster movies.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right,
classic science fiction films.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I didn't dislike The Happening at all. I watched it,
really?
there was a lot of there's a lot of suicides that take place because that's the premise of the movie. Is there's something happening, terrorist attack, who knows what at the beginning, that's making everybody just kind of flip out and want to destroy themselves. And the movie's about these people that are in that world trying to survive.
Is that Matt Damon?
No, it was Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
I don't know why I get those two mixed up, but I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a good reason to, but I just do. Yeah.
So okay. With that, yeah. So again, okay, warning given. So let's talk about the Sixth Sense. Quick synopsis. I guess everybody who's with us has seen it, but at the very beginning of the movie, there's a husband and wife. The husband is Bruce Willis. He is a child psychologist and has just won an award from the city. The mayor gave him an award. And they're admiring it, kind of enjoying the evening. So after this is after the party. So they're at home alone. And then they go upstairs and the window has been broken in. And someone is in the bathroom. And it takes Bruce Willis a minute to realize that the person that's in there is one of the kids that he had had as a patient, obviously a long time ago, because the boy is now an adult, but has got some serious problems.
Yeah.
He's standing there in his underwear, just shaking in the cold in the bathroom, and lecturing Bruce Willis on how Bruce Willis let him down. How this doctor let him down. And how could he let him down? Then, just as Bruce Willis was trying to put it together and maybe try to say some things that might help the guy deal with his problems, the guy just takes out a gun and shoots Bruce Willis right in the gut. So then the next words we see on the screen are "the next fall." And I thought that was kind of interesting. The next fall. And we see Bruce Willis sitting outside, kind of a, what do you call them, townhouses?
Yeah, I guess.
They're in Philadelphia, I believe. Yeah. I don't know what you call those houses that are right next to each other. Yeah, tenements or something. Anyway, out of this apartment or building comes this boy.
Roadhouses.
Yeah, okay.
That's it.
Haley Joel Osment. Who was very young. I mean, on this rewatch, I was stunned by how young he was. I wonder
so
how old was he? And he was tremendous.
He was 11. I think the character was written to be 8 or 9. Okay. I just happened across this recently. He was 11, but he's obviously 11 small years old. For his age. And he was amazing.
And he was amazing. And he's surprised. In like every scene in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, just about. And he's not. He's not just standing there either.
He's conveying a lot of emotion in small ways.
He's the most important thing going on in this whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because he becomes the object of this thing because Bruce Willis, and I keep saying Bruce Willis, I should use his character name.
Malcolm Crowe?
Malcolm Crowe, that's right. Dr. Malcolm Crowe. He sees this young boy as a similar case to the guy who shot him earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
And did I mention that the guy committed suicide? I didn't, but committed suicide after he shot Dr. Crow, he committed suicide. So Bruce Willis is seeing this boy as an opportunity for redemption, really.
Yeah.
He sees that as a complete failure, that previous case. And probably even more shocking was that he didn't even remember who the kid was at first, and how important the doctor was to the kid. And I'm talking about the kid at the beginning of the movie, not Haley Joel Osment. But that moment, I mean, and this is, M. Night Shyamalan keeps creating these incredible moments. And the moment where this person is yelling at him and he can't remember who he was, I thought that was something else.
I thought that was so real. But he's like, just give me a minute. Just, because he's so stunned by everything. And now he's got to try and sort through stuff and figure out who this grown-up person was.
Yeah, exactly.
He says, they called me Freak. And then he's like coming up with different names. So you're like, because you're not the only one, kid.
So to that kid was one of many.
Yeah.
Right? But that doctor was one of one.
Right.
Yeah. So the Dr. Crow sees that this next boy, Haley Joel Osment's character, Cole, he sees Cole as an opportunity for redemption. You know, he even says that to Cole later in the movie. If I can help you, well, he didn't. He was telling a story kind of in third person. You know, if I can help that kid, maybe I'd help that other kid too. And Cole understood who he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Which was, that's all. It's obvious to everyone because this was a huge hit, this movie.
Mm, yeah.
But you look at it as a Catholic and you're just like, oh my gosh, it's just Catholic to the bone.
Yeah, and it sure is. It was even more so than I thought when I picked it. As happens sometimes on this podcast, isn't it? Because I think maybe we think about things differently as we watch it.
Yes.
But Cole, you know, hustles off to a church. You know, he's in a Catholic church, which is where he tends to hang out. We never see him attend Mass or anything. But obviously the church is a place where he feels comfortable and able to relax.
Also, doesn't he go to a Catholic or private school? So I just kind of thought maybe the school was really close to it because it was maybe Catholic.
Sure could have. Right. Sure could have. Yeah. Right. He was wearing, a school uniform and things, and I didn't know that was a Catholic school. I wasn't sure.
But he does spend a lot of time there.
He spends a lot of time in there, and he's got his little guys and,
his little army
men and things. And that was an interesting scene. The first time where he's in the church, Bruce Willis starts to kind of sneak up on him, not really stealthily. He's just walking up to him, and Cole is saying some things in Latin.
Yeah.
And what was he saying? De profundis. I don't remember the whole sentence.
That's the name of the prayer.
Yeah, he's De profundis clamavi ad te, Domine.
That's it.
Yeah, which is the first line in the Psalm 129, which we call the prayer of the dead. Is that right? Or just called the De Profundis.
Out of the depths, it's called. It's just named. It's kind of like the Our Father. It's named after the first few.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a traditional prayer for the dead, right?
Yeah.
It's said on All Souls Day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I found.
Yeah. So, Psalm 129. I've got a description here in front of me. It says the De Profundis takes its name from the first two words of the psalm in Latin. It is a penitential psalm that is sung as part of Vespers and in commemoration of the dead. It is also a good psalm to express our sorrow as we prepare for the sacrament of confession. So, why don't I just read part of this?
Yes,
please. De Profundis. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my voice in supplication. If you, O Lord, mark iniquities, Lord, who can stand? But with you is forgiveness, that you may be revered. I trust in the Lord, my soul trusts in his word. My soul waits for the Lord more than sentinels wait for the dawn. More than sentinels wait for the dawn, let Israel wait for the Lord. For with the Lord is kindness, and with him is plenteous redemption. And he will redeem Israel from all their iniquities. And that's the De Profundis. So this boy Cole is uttering that. And I think that Dr. Malcolm says, is he speaking English or something like that?
Yeah, he's like, what did you say?
Yeah, what did you say?
Yeah.
And he says, no, that was Latin. And he says, do they all speak Latin? He says, no, just him.
this one guy right here.
Oh,
but he's saying it over and over. He's just whispering it, this prayer. And,
right.
And then when you found that connection to it's a good thing to say before confession.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because one of the things you discover about this movie as it goes along is everybody has a secret.
That's right. Everybody's got a secret. Yep.
Yeah. And until they open up and tell their secrets, so they're not bearing them alone, so they're sharing them, so other people can help with them, nobody can be helped. No one can move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So Cole is a troubled kid. right? I mean, he's very troubled. And one of the most touching things is the relationship between him and his mom. And you're talking about keeping stuff from him. There's a moment at which Cole is shaking and is scared to death. And his mom just says, "Why won't you tell me?" I mean, my heart broke. Yeah. My heart just broke in that scene. But she's just like, "Why won't you tell me?" You know, she gives him all the love she can give. But he's got this secret that he just can't tell.
Well, and you've seen enough of them together by that time to know she is doing everything she can. The father left them. Mm-hmm. She's working two jobs. But she and her son is, you know, the oddball who gets picked on by everybody. She isn't really aware of this for a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But so he's miserable and there's something really weird about him. And she knows this. And so she's just trying to deal with it as best she can. And I looked at that moment that you're talking about. And not only did my heart break, but I felt this huge empathy because I think I've mentioned before that when Hannah was in the eighth grade, she had a problem with extreme depression,
mm-hmm.
Which she's okay with me sharing this with people. But I mean, she had a real problem. She had a terrible problem. And I was the only one that she really could be calmed by. But it was that same feeling of you just feel so utterly helpless. You would do anything, give anything to help your child. And you can't do a thing and you know it. And that was that. I just looked at that and went, wow, that's exactly how I felt. That's how any parent feels when something's going on and you don't know what's going on and you can't fix it.
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I've experienced that surely in a minor way with my kids. You know, mm-hmm. they didn't suffer from depression, but there were times, you know, like my daughter, I recall, you know, something was going on at school and she'd wake up, her stomach was upset, you know, every morning,
but you
just couldn't get the, you know, what's going on? You know, why won't you say?
Yeah.
And then even when your kids are even smaller and they're sick or something and you can't communicate with them well enough to find out what hurts, you know, when they're that small, mm-hmm. you know, and you're just like, you know, it's just tough. That's almost, well, it's not almost, it is a Jesus moment, isn't it?
Oh,
because, you know, Jesus, tell me, right?
What do I do? Well, and I didn't have that until when my kids were little. I wasn't a believer at all. And by the time Hannah's problem came along, I was, but we weren't really active members of our church. I mean, we went, but we just weren't involved to know a lot of people. And so we went through that pretty much all by ourselves as a family.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn to lean on the Lord because that's all you can do.
Right, right. Yeah, and then, you know, in the movie, when she's like, "Why won't you tell me?" You know, that to me is that's what I meant by the Jesus moment.
Yeah.
Because she's just saying, just tell me, you know, and that's mm-hmm. what Jesus tells us to do too.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look back on things, you know, secrets that you've kept from other people and secrets that you've told and then how things start to work out only after that is mended. And the first step to mending is to tell it, you mm-hmm. know, this is what I did. That's the first step to healing. Right. And that's what Jesus asks us to do.
Right.
That's what confession is. And her anguish when she just could not understand, no matter how hard she did. She didn't stop loving him. She loved the heck out of him. But it was extremely frustrating and heartbreaking that he just wouldn't tell her.
Well, and there are moments together because he needed somebody he could trust because what his problem was, which I guess we've warned everybody away. So, mm-hmm. you know, he's seeing these apparitions.
Right.
And they actually can physically, you know, hurt him.
Yeah, so, one of the reasons to see this movie is because it is pop culture, isn't it? It's everywhere. The words I see dead people, that's right,
yeah.
is part of the whole lexicon of our age.
Yeah.
And that's where it comes from. That was his confession to Dr. Crow. He said, "I'm ready to tell you my secret now." And he didn't tell his mom the secret. But he was able to tell Dr. Crow the secret after a little while, and he told him, "I see dead people." And
But of course, the thing about him was, I remember Dr. Crow said about the guy who killed himself that he was very, very empathetic.
Yes.
I thought he said that.
He did.
And then that's something he observes in Cole also. He's very empathetic. Well, when Cole says, "I'm ready to tell you my secret," it's after he has basically said, "I think I'm got to help you."
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And he says, "If I can't help you, then everything I've done is for nothing," or something like that. And when you're looking in hindsight, knowing what happens in the movie, you realize Cole at that point, he tells him not because it will help him, Cole, he helps him because it will help the doctor.
Yeah, that's if remarkable. The doctor that's the first time I've thought of that, but you're absolutely right.
I just looked at it and I just went, wow, that's the key to both of them helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
They have to trust each other with their secret because they're there to work together. They're the answer to each other's prayer of, "Out of the depths I cry to thee, O Lord." And he sends them to each other.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's why he doesn't tell his mother. He knows she won't really understand and he can't explain it
to her.
That's
exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that's what makes it so...
I'm just blown away by that because it just like opened up a whole other door. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, that's exactly why he did that, because he was doing it for Malcolm Crowe. He wasn't doing it for himself.
Right.
He doesn't do a lot of things for himself in this whole movie. Cole doesn't.
No, and in a sense, in a very small way, he's a Christ figure that way.
Yeah, yeah.
He goes through such torment, but it's so that he can help other people through his own sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And and so when he tells that to Dr. Crowe, who then starts trying to help him, but Malcolm doesn't believe him, and he says, "Well, he is super psychotic. This is a problem."
Yeah. And after he comes out of there, he talks into his microphone or his recorder, and says, "He may require hospitalization."
Yeah, but there's a very poignant moment later too when Cole says, "You do believe me, right?" It's like, "I can't answer," which is, of course, no. And he says, "How can you help me if you won't believe me?"
Mm-hmm.
And so he makes him go deeper than the easy assumptions.
Yep.
He's got to give of himself, too. He's got to look at what he won't look at, because that's the thing that Cole tells him at the beginning about, you know, "I see dead people. They don't know they're dead. They only see what they want to see." And Dr. Crow was only seeing what he wanted to see. Oh, here's the formula that this kid fits into. Yeah. And because that's what he did with the other kid, that was his failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that kid didn't share a secret with him. There's no way he could have known that. But that's why this mattered with this kid.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought it was cool, the flashback that he did, Shyamalan did, right then when... he remembered something that the adult said at the beginning of the movie. The guy who shot himself. He said, "Do you know why you're afraid when you're alone? I do. Yeah." And then once he made that connection, he started to say, "Holy crap, is this really real?"
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then the next time he saw Cole, he suggested, "Hey, I think what you need to do is to help them." He asked him, "What do you think the ghosts want?" And then that was an interesting question, too.
Which is an interesting idea.
Yeah.
They're not just there to be scary.
Right. They're not there to be scary. But, yeah, what do you think it is that they want? And then they come to the conclusion that they want help. They want help with something. And Dr. Crow says, "Well, why don't we help them?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ask them what they want. And that moment, oh my gosh, was that like the scariest thing ever, when that ghost keeps coming after him and coming out and and the lid's coming up, opening in the tent, and you're just "There's no safe place."
Yep. And it ends it's a little girl who throws up, and he's, of course, freaks out because holy cow. But then he says, "Okay, I'm going to do this." And that was incredible, too, to watch a kid that age. And what a brilliant actor he was. or he is still, I assume. But holy cow. You know, he so screws up his courage, and he goes back to the tent, and he can see there's a ghost under this blanket.
He reaches
over there and pulls it off her head.
Oh.
And she says, "I feel a lot better now."
Yeah.
Oh. But yeah, I know, and then
he could barely get the words out. Is there something you want to tell me?
Yeah, and that was incredible too.
Yeah.
So she does tell him something, but we don't get to see exactly what.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that Shyamalan did so well in this movie is he left a lot out. You filled in a lot of stuff.
You find it later.
Right. Now, another thing that's going on throughout this movie, kind of intercut with the scenes with Cole, is Bruce Willis and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
His wife was with him when he got shot. And they're growing more and more distant. He's spending time in the basement. He's writing stuff in his journal about Cole. He can tell that his wife is getting uncomfortably close to another guy. He can tell that she's extremely sad. Yet he doesn't really try to talk to her very much. He feels a lot of emotions. He comes close, but I think that he feels responsible and maybe not ready.
When he does talk to her, like when he shows up late for their anniversary dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just talking about the case.
Exactly.
I think I can fix this. I think this will be... He never's talking about them or anything she'd care about. It's always about his work. And at the very beginning, she says, "You won this because you put everything else, including me, second."
Yeah.
And she's laughing it off, but you don't say stuff like that if you don't mean it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you don't see a change in that pattern.
Yeah, you don't at all. Right. So, so that's going on. I just want to make sure we mention that as we go through this whole thing. All right, so then Cole gets a message. There's my cat. Cole gets a message from this ghost girl. And he and Dr. Crow get on a bus, and they take a bus to, we assume, where she told them to go. And Cole says, "Wow, she sure came a long way to see me, didn't she?"
Out there.
Yeah.
The neighborhoods are changing.
So, a long ways away. So, they get to this house, and there's a funeral going on. And Cole and Dr. Crow go upstairs. Cole goes by himself into her room. And that was a jump. Arm shoots out from under the bed. You never get stuff jumping from under the bed.
Oh,
shoot. That's a line from the... Did you ever see The Prophecy? The Angel movie where Vig Mortensen plays Satan?
No.
Oh, my. It's a fun movie to watch.
But
he said one of his lines in this movie, he says, "All those times you were scared that I was under the bed, I was..."
Oh, no. Don't tell me things like that. My brother and
that was Viggo. Viggo Mortensen from Lord of the Rings.
Under the twin beds in my room that I shared with my sister, and they shot their hands out and grabbed me from under the...
Oh, my gosh.
I was already scared of the dark. That's was bad enough.
That's sick and wrong.
That's bad. We were kids, but still.
You bet.
Yes. Oh, Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah, he plays Satan in that movie. That's an interesting movie. It's about angels. Second War in Heaven. Gabriel is played by Christopher Walken.
Whoa.
And Gabriel is rebelling against heaven now.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so it's a interesting kind of a cult film.
Huh, okay.
Called Prophecy. I don't know if it's The Prophecy or just Prophecy. I don't recall.
If I look for those two names with it, I'm sure I'd find it.
Yeah. Christopher Walken as an angel.
Well, rebelling against heaven, that works for me.
Yeah. okay. So, all right. So she pushes a box. This ghost pushes a box out from under the bed, and he takes the box downstairs and he gives it to That was an incredible scene too. Can you imagine what you'd be feeling? I mean, he goes up to this girl's dad who's totally in mourning. He's like, "Excuse me,
are you her dad?"
And he just nods his head, and he just says, "Here." She wanted to tell you something.
Yeah,
and he doesn't know. Yeah, he doesn't even have any clue what it is. He's just,
and they leave.
Yeah, incredibly brave kid. I mean, that's just what I kept feeling over and over.
Yeah.
And again, doing this for other people.
Well, and that was also one of the touches that they did with his character, or his dialogue, I guess, that really reminded you of how young and vulnerable he was. Are you so-and-so's daddy?
Yeah, yeah.
And he would call his mom Mama, didn't he?
Right, yep. Yeah,
or Mommy.
Mm-hmm.
Mama, I think. But it was one of those things where it's, you know, still a little kid.
Right, right.
Having to do this.
Yep. And then inside the box is a videotape, and the guy, when he watches the tape, sees something horrible. he sees his wife, I assume, feeding poison to the kid who died.
Right.
Yep. So terrible.
And they had said, but the little daughter is the young daughter is now starting to get sick too.
Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah. That's right.
But that was some of the conversation as they were walking through the room, and somebody goes, "Oh God, help them." You know, and I was like, oh, you don't hear that much. And then you're going, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that called Munchausen's?
Yeah, isn't Munchausen's when you start to feel sick because someone else is sick? Is that right?
Or somebody's making you sick, or you're making somebody sick. Okay, we're completely uninformed, everybody. There's a thing. That thing that's in the movie, that was a thing. It's got a name and everything.
That's right. That's right.
It's a horrible thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so unthinkable. And that moment when the mother turns around with this little smile on her face that kind of freezes, and the father's just standing there looking at her, and so is everybody else who was in his part of the room when he was watching the video.
Yeah, yeah.
The looks of horror on their faces and disgust were just... really, what a powerful scene.
Wow. And did you happen to notice how little music there was in this movie?
I actually did.
Yeah, I thought that was remarkable. And I found a little video where Shyamalan talks about music in his movies. I think he's used James Newton Howard for most of his movies. Mm-hmm. And he did on this one. And he was talking about The Sixth Sense. And he said that he likes to... put the movie together for as long as possible without any music at all. So he said he wants a scene to work without any music. And he says, because, you know, a lot of people use it as a crutch. He said, you know, boy, there's something not working with this scene. Well, now if we put, you know, some big song in there, now it works beautifully. Isn't that awesome? You know, Bruce Springsteen is singing now, and now it's cool, you know, but he wanted it to work without any music. And then he would add the music at the latest possible time. And I don't remember the exact amount of time, but he said that James Newton Howard came on for The Sixth Sense at the very end and was with him for like 6 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and that was all the music that they put in The Sixth Sense.
Huh. Well, I was listening particularly to the music because... I've discovered, I think it's WNYC radio station, has a weekly show called Movies on the Radio.
Ooh,
And it's an hour-long show. It's on Saturday evenings at 9 o'clock. And David Garland loves the movies, and he talks about, you know, movie scores.
Oh, how about that? Oh, I love that.
And it goes back to...
Is that on a podcast, or how are you catching it?
It's not in a podcast, but they're actually still streaming a lot of the shows.
Okay.
So you can just go and listen.
Okay, cool.
And so I've been looking at a lot of them and listening to some of them, and they have... I mean, I listened to one today, Scott. Okay, this is off topic, everyone, but you'll all get this. Star Trek television music.
Ooh.
You know, oh yeah, they did that one. But you know what I didn't realize? There's this huge long buildup to it. And when you're listening, it's almost like listening to one of these more modern composers.
Oh, really?
It's atonal, and it sounds like it's a full orchestra. And it's the same thing as when, you know, they'd have all these names now do scripts for them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these were some big people who were doing the music for this show or that show.
Oh, wow.
So he's playing some of this music and you're going, I recognize this. In fact, I'm not sure if I should be proud or ashamed, but I would know what was happening in some of them from what I heard. But anyway, but I would listen to them thinking, I didn't realize how complex this music was. Uh-huh. It was really amazing. And this guy is very laid back. He's not throwing tons of energy into it, but he's got just these little tidbits of information he drops out. Then he goes, well, now let's listen to another one. And I was thinking about him, especially because when you said Shyamalan has the theory of not using very much music. And I noticed that because since I was listening to that show, I was paying more attention than usual. Two things. One is I noticed a lot of times during the scary scenes, the music was not scary.
Hmm.
I mean, it wasn't that psycho kind of thing. Sometimes it was, where you were ratcheted up to where you're like, I think I'm going to die right now. But sometimes it was fairly calm because the music was, I mean, the movie was carrying it. But it also made me think of the contrast with Hans Zimmer in Inception.
Mm-hmm.
Because this Movies on the Radio had one about Hans Zimmer, and it was right after Inception came out. And he played about 15 or 20 minutes worth of that score. So I was listening, and what it did was you could see how the music was integral. I mean, the music was integral to that movie. It was almost like another piece of it. And the movie could happen without it, but you could kind of hear the music taking you down through the levels. You could hear it taking you back up. You could hear these themes being repeated all the time because it was very complex. And so in that, it's funny that it was completely the other, the music itself was like a character.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, by the time I got to, I listened to that music three times in a row, I just went, I'm going back and hear it again.
Yeah, you know? I know there are some scores that are just so distinctive and fun, like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes.
Boy, listen, that just charges me right up. Makes me ready, I want to go get somebody.
Well, an exception.
It's like Rocky music for other people, I guess.
I was kind of melancholy. Mm-hmm. But also, the way it all builds up, I was like, yes, now things are happening. Things are going to be okay. So it's that same thing.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Whereas this music wasn't quite that way.
Huh. Yeah.
I will put a link to that Movies on the Radio.
Please do. Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
That's something I'd definitely check out.
Yeah.
Well, cool. So, okay, back to the movie. What were we? Oh, yeah. Cole started helping these ghosts out, right? And through that, has found his purpose and his peace. Because he starts to understand, okay, hey, this is working out. This isn't as terrible as I thought it would be. And it's going to be okay.
Well, and he's not a victim. He has something he can do.
Yeah, exactly. And things start to go better for him at school and things. And then Malcolm, you see Dr. Crow and him at his school, and Cole says, I'm not going to see you anymore, am I? And Dr. Crow says, well, I think maybe we're done. We've said everything to each other that we need to. And so they basically said goodbye. But then Cole said something pretty interesting. He said, because they had talked a little bit about the relationship between Dr. Crow and his wife during Cole's therapy. And Cole says, hey, why don't you talk to your wife while she's sleeping? She'll hear you. And he said, okie doke.
That's a good idea.
So then he goes home, Dr. Malcolm Crow, and he goes home to his wife. His wife is watching the video of their wedding.
She's laying there. Asleep.
She's falling asleep. She's just like on the very edge, just falling asleep. And she says, Malcolm, why did you leave me? And drops his ring on the ground. And he looks at his hand and he's like, holy crap, why isn't that ring on this hand? And that's when, I can't tell you the first time that I saw this movie, and you said you knew it already.
Unfortunately.
But when I saw this movie, that moment, I mean, it blew me away. I could not believe it. And, you know, Malcolm had died when he got shot at the beginning of the movie. And throughout the entire movie, he's a ghost. And he's talking to Cole, and Cole is helping him just like he said he needed to do with the other ghosts. You know?
Right.
He's he's helping Malcolm. And he's the only nice ghost that
Cole had ever met.
Right. And Cole even said, you know, when you think about it and you go back, you're like, oh my gosh, Cole said that if, you know, sometimes ghosts don't even know that they're ghosts. And he said this, and what about, you know, I remember thinking, well, what about that scene in the restaurant where he was talking to his wife, and you replay that scene, and she never talked to him once. But she, you know, Shyamalan did these subtle, amazing things where she made eye contact with him.
Right.
One time. But if you listen to the sound, somebody drops a dish in the distance.
Oh.
And she looks up at the dish.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's just incredible.
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting. I was wondering your reaction since you'd seen it pure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because when I saw it, I liked the way he did the thing of suddenly flashing back through all the things that show you here and here and here and here. But I was wondering if it seemed, I don't know, I was just wondering if it was really necessary or if it was kind of a conceit of the director's.
It was astounding because I think it was a conceit of the director, but it was exactly what I was thinking at that moment. I was thinking, no way. How could he possibly have pulled this off?
But that's why
as someone who's interested in stories, right? I was amazed and delighted.
Yeah.
I mean, when someone does that to you in a movie and you know, that's why I keep railing. I mean, for the last couple podcasts, I've said, watch the movie without hearing about it, you know, because, I mean, it's so rare and perfect a feeling, you know, when they just get you like that. And then, and then to find out how wonderfully it was put together was remarkable. And that little flashback part isn't what told me that. But when I first saw the movie, that's what I thought was no way. I cannot believe it. I think I've been ripped off.
Well, because I was watching it.
And then he flashes those things back and you're like, oh my gosh. And then it's not until you see it again that you realize how incredible it is. And, and because it is intricately put together and everything's there for you. I mean, I don't doubt for a minute that people watch this movie and figure it out before the end, but I've heard this more than about this movie than any other, that people say, oh man, I was totally taken.
I don't know how you would if you hadn't heard some hint, because he is so present everywhere. And all the times when he's ignored, there are times that you expect it, when the would-be boyfriend is driving away and he's yelling at him in the street. Well, of course.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to pay attention. You're the husband.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Right.
So, and for me, watching it, especially the second time when I knew the story so I could kind of pay more attention, I actually liked those flashbacks, even though I had watched them for what they were at the moment, because it basically took you into his head. It's probably a conceit of the director's, and he's accused of being conceited. Okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I like his movies, and I don't care. But to me, you were just seeing everything Bruce Willis was thinking too. You know, you were thinking that, but Bruce Willis is like, oh no.
Yeah.
And the fact that the door is always locked and he has to reach for his key and he's just down there.
Yeah.
He doesn't ever go down the stairs, and then he sees there's a table against it and he couldn't have gotten through. And then it was the kid saying they only see what they want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about that? Just something else. Bravo, Mr. Shyamalan.
He did what he needed to do for her, which was he told her, you were never second.
That's right, yep.
That's what she needed.
So once he comes to his senses saying, oh my gosh, this is really what's happening, he comes to his senses and he, I don't know, I guess the word closure, I mean, he provides her what she needs. He gives her what she needs, and he says, tomorrow morning when you wake up, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he realizes that this is what she needs.
Yeah.
And
how about the scenes, too, where, because you expect that to be the end of the movie,
mm-hmm.
And it isn't because
and
they
it's not, and it's wonderful that it's not because we needed that one more thing. Because we would have thought Cole's going to spend the rest of his life. You know, if it had ended there, is Cole spending the rest of his life not telling his mom? And I can just, you know, feel her pain.
Oh, you know,
strange things are happening. She doesn't understand. He does. It's even worse now. And, but we get to see the moment where he tells her, I'm ready to communicate with you now.
She's like, communicate with me.
She's like, what?
Yeah.
And he tells her, he says, up there, that accident, they're not okay. Somebody died. And she's like, wow, you can see that? That's amazing. How can you see that from here? And he says, no. This lady's standing right outside my window. And then you get to see this lady who's passed away. You know, she's got blood on her head and stuff. And she's standing right outside his window.
Yeah.
And Toni Collette slowly starts to understand and put it all together as he's telling her things that her mom passed on.
I was gonna say, I think to me that was really powerful because once again I really related personally to Toni Collette when she's sitting there and he's like, I can see ghosts, you know, and she's like, uh-huh. And he says and they tell me to do things for them. Okay.
Yeah, and I
she's
can only
grabbing I, her head and
I
going,
can only imagine just, she's thinking, oh my gosh, how am I possibly gonna get him to the doctor? Who am I going to have to see?
Right.
How much is this going to cost me? How can I possibly do that working two jobs? And I think I feel like that's what she's thinking.
Oh, I will tell you, I know it because that's exactly how I felt when Hannah told me she had synesthesia, except she didn't know the name for it, basically. And have I told you this story?
Yeah, you have.
Yeah. So, so she, basically I was just sitting there doing the same thing. I was like, I'm okay. She's not getting better. I thought she was getting better. I'm going to have to take, she won't have to be committed, will she? And then and then Rose said, oh no, I've heard about this. And I went, what? So it's that same thing of grandma.
Yeah.
These things.
Right. Yep. And, yeah, that's pretty much the end of the movie right there, after that experience.
And it was really great, I thought, that not only was that used to the grandmother's, the things a grandmother had told Cole, were used to convince the mother, but the mother and grandmother needed closure over something. He had to help his grandmother, too. That she'd never told the mother that she watched her at a dance recital and they'd been mad and...
Yeah,
the answer to her question is every day, and you know all these things were, you know, I was wiping away big tears at the end.
Yeah, so what a movie that is.
Yes, thank you for making me see this. I only remembered the being scared for a couple weeks.
Yeah, and that was, you know, when you said at the beginning that it wasn't as scary as you remembered it. It was the same for me, you know, watching it this time. I remember it being a very frightening movie. And I think that it's because of the tension and everything that he built up. And once you've seen it once, you kind of know where those places are. And it's just remarkable. I think he's a remarkable filmmaker.
Well, I was reading something that just a second ago that said that Toni Collette, who played the mother, didn't realize it was a horror movie until she was watching it or something.
Oh, wow.
Huh. Because she was so caught up in the emotional response to that the mother and child had to each other, that she was just not thinking of it that way.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
How would you not?
I don't. Yeah. How would you not know? I remember. You know, we talked about The Shining once by Kubrick. I remember seeing him. It was in an extra or something where they were saying that the little boy in that movie had no idea that he was in a horror movie.
Oh.
And they filmed it in a way and treated him in a way that he never, ever knew.
Oh, well, that's good, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting. But, it's interesting that she would, I wonder what the script was like.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she didn't have the only scene she had with Bruce Willis, they were just kind of sitting there across from each other.
Yeah. They never talked, but you know, it's, you know, that scene, you assume
that
they had just been talking for like a half hour.
Yeah. You know? When she says, "I'll make you pancakes, you've got an hour."
Right.
And then walks away.
And you're thinking she just left him there for an hour.
Yeah.
To talk to Dr. Crow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something else. Yeah. I go on and on. Now, do you have any other movies of his that you liked?
I like all of them, really. Well, yeah. I didn't see The Happening, although I suppose I might watch it now that you've given
Is it the best movie ever? You know, it's very good. I thought it was exactly what Rose said. It's exactly what she said.
Well, and especially with what I've read about it, since after I read so many bad reviews, I was like, okay, I'm just going to read. I'm not going to try to protect myself from it.
Yeah.
So I kind of know the basic theme. And so then when I think of the fact that, you know, the Japanese horror movies about radiation and the movies that we would have about different monsters, you know, and even like this TV show, I don't know if you've seen it, Last Resort. It's new. It has Andre Brouwer in it,
Oh, is that about a submarine or something?
Yeah, he's basically, he's given a command to nuke Palestine, Palestinians. But instead of coming through normal channels, it comes through the Antarctic station, which is only supposed to be used if there's no other communication available.
Uh-huh.
And they can communicate. And he's like, I would like to talk to somebody who I know. And they're like, oh, so you're not going to do what you're supposed to? So then they send out someone to attack them, and they wind up on this island. And he's like, well, yeah, I know all you regular sailors are kind of upset with me, but, you know, something's going on. And what it's doing is between his character and his XO's wife who's back home and a few characters, basically what you're seeing is there's a big conspiracy to take over our government. And I just look at this, and to me, it's like watching one of those movies, because what it's preying on is the fact that there's Homeland Security. Uh-huh. They seem to have a lot of power that isn't necessarily always talked about, and that's what this movie is doing. It's going, this is kind of creepy, let's use it. And so I think about when you said that, and Rose had said it, about the being a throwback to the horror movies of the 50s, I suddenly was like, oh. Then in that case, knowing what I know, I guess that is what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Preying on the fears that people have.
Right, right.
Or using those to tell a story.
Yeah.
But I like, you know, I heard everybody just, well, I think that Signs was the first movie of his I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Which I loved. And then later I heard everybody upset because there weren't enough aliens. I was like, there were plenty of aliens. That wasn't the point of the movie.
Signs was a terrific movie, you know, and we could certainly have selected that one for this podcast because, you know, it's a movie about faith, it's blatantly about faith. And I think some people didn't enjoy it because of that. You know, they don't like coincidences,
right?
And things of that nature. To me, I absolutely loved it, but, you know, there is a big, giant thing that I had to ignore as a science fiction fan. If we ever talk about it.
Someday I'm going to pick that movie sometime.
All right, that sounds great. And I absolutely adore that movie.
I love, that's where I kind of discovered Joaquin Phoenix also, who's one of those actors who I will actually watch a movie I might not like for.
Have you seen The Master yet?
No, but I've heard it's wonderful.
I have not either. Okay. So
I've heard it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And but I liked what was the one? Unbreakable.
Yes, Unbreakable.
That was good.
That was great. Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh my gosh! Yes, and comic book come to life.
Oh yeah.
And then what is it? The Village.
The Village, yeah.
That's the one where people just really started dumping on him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, becoming kind of a director that's known for a twist or known for the killer end, you know, I think that is extremely hard to maintain because now you feel like you need to provide that. And people are now watching your movies looking for that. You know, The Sixth Sense came at everybody from nowhere. But, you know, now when you watch an M. Night Shyamalan movie, you're like, okay, whatever's going to happen, I'm going to be watching, you know, and I'm going to get this one. I'm going to get this one.
Well,
and I think The Village was maybe a bridge too far. No, The Happening was not.
Okay.
It was not. Nope.
So he's trying to break out maybe with some of this other stuff.
Maybe so. Just trying something a little bit different, but it's got to be exhausting. You know, you can't provide that in every film.
Yeah. Well, and I could see people's problems with it, but I liked it. I didn't have a problem with it. I had a problem with the main people's choices.
Yeah.
But especially at the end, but you know, that wasn't my choice to make. That was their main choice.
Thing I remember about that movie was that several people were saying it was plagiarism. He took a story from I can't remember what it was. It could have been The Giver, but I don't think that was it. It was some storybook. I don't recall. It's probably on the net. I have no idea how that ended up. You know, hopefully everybody's happy now. It's kind of like, you know, when Harlan Ellison, I never know. Harlan Ellison seems to claim a lot of different things.
And
I don't know what he's suing somebody for at the moment, but it's probably something. But like the Terminator, he said the Terminator was his idea. And how close, you know, I really don't know. I haven't read the story that he claims that it was taken from, but I think that he won something off of that one.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and then the other one was, and I can't remember the name, but it's about Story. The main character is Dallas Bryce Howard again, and I think her name is Story.
Lady in the Water?
That's it, Lady in the Water. And that was the one where everybody was just like, oh, that's it, he's lost it. We just went ahead and we're like, I mean, it was a year or two after, we watched it at home, but we watched it, all of us, all four of us went, we liked it.
Yeah. I felt the same way. Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand that stuff. And I felt exactly that way about The Happening.
Yeah.
You know, I liked it.
Okay, well, I'll try it then.
So, you know, the one that he's been vilified over is The Last Airbender. People were just really upset about that. And now I'm going to need to watch it.
Well, yeah. And I know some kids who, well, say kids like early 20s, I guess, who went to see it when it came out, going, we're going to see it anyway. And they all had watched all of The Last Airbender already.
Mm-hmm.
And they came away just very upset.
So is it that they were upset because the story was changed? Or
yeah.
That was it?
It wasn't faithful to what it should have been.
Yeah, I wonder whose decision that was. I really don't know enough about that situation. But
yeah,
that happens so often where you have something that's so incredibly successful, like a book. You know, how many times have we seen a movie where they've changed something fundamental about the story when they took it from a book that, you know, I've come out of movies before wondering why they even put the name they put on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, do you remember the Patriot Games with Harrison Ford?
Not a terrible movie. It's fine.
But at the same time, I came out of there because I remember I read the book before I saw the movie. I mean, almost back to back.
Oh, okay.
And when I saw the movie, I was like, there wasn't a single scene in there that was the same as the book. And it was just like, why do that?
We were reading Tom Clancy at the time. And we went, oh, we'll go see it. And we did. And we came out going, well, it was a fine movie, but what happened?
It just didn't make any sense why they would buy it. It was like they just bought the name and made their own movie.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
I don't know. Doesn't make any sense to me, but whatever. I don't think I remember the big bucks.
I think I remember hearing, and I could have this wrong, but I think I remember hearing that M. Night Shyamalan had never seen The Last Airbender when he directed the movie. So, and I know,
yeah, and see that's a trap right there, isn't it? You know, when you have a built-in fan base,
yeah,
and there's expectations,
yeah. So, but it could be like the whole John Carter of Mars thing. We loved it, and all these people. And, of course, Hollywood, it costs so much money and, you know, lost more money.
Yeah, I wonder what happened there. I mean, did people really dislike it or did they just...
People like
it came
me,
out at, like, a wrong time or something? It was like, eh.
Well, people like us we would say, well, you know, we watched John Carter, and they go, hey, I liked it. What did you think?
Yeah. Isn't that odd?
And that somebody was saying, oh, it might have been Mark Kermode. Or maybe, oh, no, it was, I think, Peter Travers, who does Rolling Stone movie reviews. Mm-hmm. He gave it, you know, a high average, as did Roger Ebert review. Mm-hmm. And he, most of his review was railing against the people who were letting out all the money, production numbers on money and all this. He goes, you know, if this movie had been allowed to just come into the theater as what it was, just an entertaining movie about all this, he goes, it would have done really well in the U.S. Mm. He goes, but no, it was sabotaged from the beginning. Andrew Stanton didn't have a chance. And I think it did, though, very well overseas.
Oh, that's good.
So, I mean, our priest was like, I'm mad. I want a sequel. And I said, I'm pretty sure you're not getting that from these people. And he's like, well, you don't think
that's
so?
That's too bad. Yeah, that's too bad.
I know. So, well, but so it's that same thing. And when I was talking to Hannah, who's read several of the John Carter books, I was telling her about it a little because she hadn't seen it yet. And she said, oh, it sounds like they compressed two or three books into the movie. And I said, well, I could see that. Those books are kind of simple, really. Yeah,
they are, right.
If they're like Tarzan.
Mm-hmm.
Since same author.
Yeah, yeah. So. Wow.
But.
Well, neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's all of his movies.
Yeah.
Big fan. I'll watch his next one, too. Hope he keeps making them.
Yeah, I know. He will.
Yeah. If I look at IMDb here, I didn't happen to see what he's got coming up. After Earth. Oh. Okay, in the movie Devil, he's credited with the story.
Okay. I think I'd heard that.
After Earth. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talked about this last time. Will Smith, Elizabeth Furman, Jaden Smith,
yes.
Zoe Kravitz.
Yeah.
After a crash landing, a father and son explore a planet that was evacuated by humans 1,000 years earlier.
Okay. Yeah.
Exciting, 2013.
Yeah, and Rose was saying he said he wasn't going to do anything that wasn't PG-13, Will Smith, because of his kids.
Oh, good.
Which is kind of interesting.
Sixth Sense, we should mention, was PG-13. The Happening was rated R.
Well, I heard it was very violent.
The Happening?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was gory. There was those suicide moments are difficult, a lot of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
but as far as storyline and all that, the rest of it would be PG-13.
Yeah. Well, and I could see that for The Sixth Sense, although you'd have to be a mature young person. I mean, not, you know, teenager, but don't let your 12-year-old go if they're, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of things are suggested that aren't shown.
Right. Right.
And you know, it's scary.
I wonder if you have a movie that does that suggesting thing, which this movie does.
Yeah.
You're filling in the blanks with your own mind. You know, when you're 12, what are you filling in there? Are you filling in stuff that's incredibly horrifying, or are we adults doing that to ourselves? I don't know.
Well, I'm trying to remember how old Rose was when I brought this movie home. This was long enough ago. Gosh, 5 years ago. So she wasn't 12. But I'd had Tom and Hannah were out of town. I rented it and watched it and went, that wasn't scary because I watched it during the day and all this. And Rose was, can I watch it? I went, sure. So she watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had to sleep with her closet light on for 2 weeks. So
you bet.
It was a little problem. So, yeah, so it had a delayed reaction, actually. So the watching of it wasn't a problem, but it was everything it left you with.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, have you seen any horror movies lately that you'd recommend?
I don't really.
You don't really watch those? There's one that I've seen that I've really, really liked. And it's called Super 8. It's a Steven Spielberg movie.
Oh, yeah. We did see that. I don't think of that as a horror movie.
Yeah, I guess not. It's a monster movie. Kind of a monster movie, but I love that movie. I love it. There's something about those kids that I think just caught me, and I like to watch them. These kids are making a movie in the movie, and I just thought it was terrific. I really enjoyed it.
And it was obviously an homage to people who love movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it twice.
And yeah.
Yeah.
But well, the thing that makes it, you know, it's not that it's not predictable. It is, and it's, you know, it's just that the way that you get there and those kids and what they're doing and going through, they were just terrific.
And I liked the monster, actually. Yeah,
the monster was pretty cool.
Yeah, quite a lot of sympathy for the monster, although it's no E.T. monster.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think the last movie I saw that I would recommend like that, I already told you about, which is The Body Snatcher.
Mm.
With Boris Karloff.
That's right, yeah.
Where I'm now a fan for life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably nothing. I'll see him
I
and go,
need to
oh,
catch that.
No
yeah.
Body Snatcher.
I definitely need to catch that.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I was thinking, though, in this movie, when there were two things that occurred to me. One was that when Cole says, you know, the dead people, they only see what they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that really comes out is even when you're alive, and especially when you're alive, we can't help other people if we're not being honest first. Mm-hmm. There's confession is one thing, but you have to admit to yourself before you can confess to somebody else.
Yeah.
And you can't help yourself or anybody else if you're going to fudge the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's we just see what we want to see. We put the blinders on.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no question. No question.
Yeah. And then the other thing was, and we talked several times about how brave Cole was, and of course he was incredibly brave, but the thing that he did that was really brave, I thought, and also the doctor at the end, was they had to make themselves vulnerable. They had to take a leap of faith into terrifying situations. And of course, Cole's situations were truly terrifying. But he had, as you pointed out, he had to walk up and say, "Are you so-and-so's daddy?"
Mm-hmm.
Here.
Yeah.
That was just as hard for him as going into the room where the girl had left the box.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And, yep.
And the doctor had to give up. He potentially, you know, at the time when he didn't realize what situation he was in, but at the time he potentially gave up his career in a way, all of his training at the very least,
oh,
to say,
yeah,
yes, maybe this is really true.
Yeah.
And
when
I'm going to follow where this takes me and I'm going
to
ignore what I've been told, you know? So
yeah
that is the vulnerability
to
too. Yeah.
Because he never even investigated it before.
He never did, yep.
Or thought about it.
Right, right. Yep.
And that's something that, although the thing I love about M. Night Shyamalan's movies in general, and it's the same thing you're saying, is there's that faith element, but there's also that element of making us be true to ourselves, because that's the whole point, or that's one of the points of faith anyway. You can't get anywhere if you're not true to yourself and honest.
Right. Yep.
And it sometimes what you have to do, I mean, I don't mean to make it sound weird for people who don't have faith who might be listening, but sometimes you have to take a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go, all right, I will ask if I should give this talk. All right, I will, you know, say I'll do this thing. I'll volunteer for this thing. You know, and that doesn't sound like anything, but it can feel just as difficult as some of those things Cole did.
Yeah.
You know?
That's for certain.
So.
Sure can. Yep.
I didn't mean to bring us down.
No, don't bring us down. I mean, a lot to learn from this movie. I mean,
yeah.
It's good in so many ways.
Yeah.
And it really does. Surprised me this time through.
Yeah.
Again, you know. A surprise in one way and now a second way.
I know. I know. My husband came home right as the last of it was happening and he said, oh, so I missed it. And I was like, well, don't feel too lucky because now I've decided it's not so scary that you wouldn't like it. And I'm going to watch it again sometime. And he was like, oh, great.
No.
I know. You're going to have to plan another meeting really fast.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Fantastic. All right.
I don't know. Did I ask you about the movie I was thinking about?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not that I recall. Go ahead.
Have you seen The Paper?
No.
Directed by Ron Howard, starring a multitudinous cast.
Huh.
Michael Keaton, Marissa Tomei, Randy Quaid.
No.
not Henry Fonda, maybe? Glenn Close? Oh, I mean, wow. A zillion people.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't seen it?
No, I have not.
Well, all right.
Not that I recall.
That will be my movie.
All right, fantastic. Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so in 2 weeks on November 8th, we're going to have a heroines past and present talk with Heather Ordover, Rose Davis, and Joseph Suzanka.
Yes.
Yeah, that was fun.
Because of schedules,
we had to tape it. It's in the can, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to play that for you on November 8th. I hope you enjoy it. Yes. We sure did. And on November 22nd, Bleak House by Charles Dickens. And you laugh, but I'm enjoying it so far. I'm
You've got another month to finish.
My Kindle says I'm 10% through it. And yeah, I'm enjoying the heck out of it. I like it.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, he's got a great style, and he's funny. It's very funny.
I know, don't expect it.
Right. Jarndyce? Is that right?
Yes. Have you gotten to Mrs. Jellyby yet?
Yes, yep.
I was reading big sections of that aloud to my husband. I'd start laughing, and he's going, "Is it that lady again?" I was like, "Yes, I just have to read you this one thing."
Oh, fun. Yep.
So, yeah.
So enjoyable, yeah.
Good, good. I'm glad.
And then after that, we're doing the paper.
Yes.
And then after that, right before Christmas break, on December the 20th, we're going to do The Hobbit.
Ooh.
Which is... kind of cool timing because the first Hobbit movie will be out. So we do in the book The Hobbit, not the film.
Ah.
Although I hope to be able to talk about the film too.
When will the film come out?
The film will come out on the 14th of December.
So the week before we're going to talk. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know if I can get to it by then, but maybe I can. I'd be curious to see how it is since they're doing it. It must be done in incredible detail.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be something.
Three movies out of that.
Three movies is what I'm hearing. Yep.
Well, it is action-packed. As I recall.
Yeah, we'll have to see how they do it. But it's interesting, you know, Lord of the Rings was huge, and they did three movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I hope this isn't a case of, hey, look how much cool stuff we filmed. We can't possibly lose this stuff, can we? No, let's make three movies.
Oh. Yeah.
I hope not.
Right.
I hope not.
But, you know, The Hobbit is... full. It's jam-packed full. I'm just thinking through some of the stuff. I've read it three or four times maybe, but not for a long time. It's got so much in it that you kind of wonder if he couldn't have cut down The Lord of the Rings a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, probably
could have. Since he was writing that for adults. There were parts I skim over every time.
Yeah. Well, I'll just have
that's
to
great.
Tell work that I'm going to see The Hobbit sometime that week.
Okay.
Well, I have a funny story. There's a guy I used to work with. His name was Al. Hi, Al. And he was movie crazy. So I remember he came to work on the day the Planet of the Apes came out.
Huh.
And he just couldn't stand it. He couldn't stand not being down there. And by down there, I mean, I lived in Malad. Movies are 45 minutes away. So down there means you got to drive to go see a movie.
Right.
So he told his supervisor, he said, "Hey, I really just need to go see Planet of the Apes." And his supervisor said, "Just go back to work. You don't need to see Planet of the Apes." So maybe 20 minutes goes by and he goes and he talks to the guy above him, above his supervisor, and says, I just got to go see Planet of the Apes. And the guy told him, "What are you telling me for? Just go to work. You can't, you know, I'm not letting you go."
Yeah.
So he works about 15 minutes, and he drops his stuff, goes across the street to the office, the main office, to the owner.
Oh, man.
And he tells the owner, I got to go see Planet of the Apes.
What is
this is a small town. We all know each other.
Yeah.
The owner said, "Get out of here. Just go."
You're not getting any work done. You're just bothering us.
So off he went to Planet of the Apes. That's what I'm going to have to do when I go see The Hobbit, maybe. To make sure I get to see it before then. And he was a funny guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and who's in that? Is that Jeremy? No.
Who's in which? The Hobbit or Planet of the Apes?
Hobbit. I'm sorry, The Hobbit. Yes, I do.
Yeah, the guy, have you seen any of the Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's the Watson guy, isn't it?
Yeah, Watson. Mm-hmm.
That's when Tom said, oh, I see who's in it. And he told me, and I can't remember his name. He goes, uh-huh. And I was like, really? And he said, yes, I know. We're going to have to see it. It's like, well, once he looks like a hobbit, it
could
might
you not
be different.
See it? Yeah, that's impossible. Here he is, Benedict Cumberbatch.
No, that's Sherlock Holmes.
Oh,
this is Watson.
He's playing the Necromancer.
Oh, he
Hugo
is.
Hugo Weaving is Elrond, of course. Martin Freeman is Bilbo.
That's it, Martin Freeman.
And
that's Watson.
There's a guy named
so
Luke
they're
Evans.
Both in it?
Apparently so. It says Benedict Cumberbatch is the Necromancer, whatever
crazy
that is.
Good.
And then Elijah Wood, Christopher Lee, Orlando Bloom gets to be in it.
Okay.
Kate Blanchett, Evangeline
right.
Lilly, Ian
yeah,
McClellan, Richard Armitage, Andy Serkis is Gollum, yeah. Ian Holm is Old Bilbo. Yep, how fun.
Wow.
Yep.
And speaking of Sherlock Holmes, the BBC one, which is so wonderful, I tried watching Elementary, which is the American series that just started with Lucy Liu as Watson and some British guy whose name I don't remember as Sherlock Holmes. They're in New York City, and we kind of got done and we went, well, it's a quirky mystery, but I've already seen House, which is kind of what this reminds me of, even though it's not medical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, the BBC's done it so well, it's ruined me for other ones.
Ruined you for other Holmeses.
Well, there's no great graphics to go with it, but it's not as cleverly written, you know.
Yeah,
I know
yeah.
they're trying.
Cool.
I'm just giving you the advance notice. Don't waste your time.
I mentioned to my wife, who is going through a kind of a BBC phase of her life, watching all kinds of mystery shows from the BBC. I told her about Luther, which Heather told us about last time.
Right.
And she loves it. She's already done.
Wow.
There's two 6-episode seasons, I think. And, she said to say thanks to Heather, so I will be sure and do that.
Well, now, have you watched any of it?
I did. I did. There's no way I could keep up with her, but I watched some of it, and I loved what I saw.
Okay.
The actor in there, I think his name is Idris Elba, is stunning. I mean, he's great. Absolutely
really?
Wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have it on my list, but I guess I'm going to have to move it closer to the top.
Yeah, and I don't know if you have Netflix, but it's on there. I think she mentioned that it was on Amazon, too.
Yeah, I have Amazon Prime.
Yeah, so. It's called Luther.
Right. Yep, I have it, and I'm now writing it in a Sharpie on a Post-it note.
All right.
On the outside of my notebook. That's priority.
Yeah, okay. Cool. All right, well, we'll catch you next time, everybody. See you in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.